From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with political writers David Horowitz and Peter Collier. Their collaboration has taken them from the New Left, when they co-edited Ramparts magazine in the 1960s, to a neoconservative stand in the 1980s. Also today, I speak with author Susan Cheever. Cheever was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award for her memoir of her father, John Cheever. Her new novel is titled Doctors and Women. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles The Great Society, the band Grace Slick sang with before the Jefferson Airplane, and book critic John Leonard reviews Don't Tread on Me, the selected letters of S.J. Perlman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guests are David Horowitz and Peter Collier. In the 1960s, they were co-editors of Ramparts, the leading New Left anti-war magazine. A few years ago, Horowitz and Collier underwent a political conversion to neoconservatism. In a 1985 Washington Post magazine article, they explained why they voted for Ronald Reagan. They said that voting for Reagan is a way of saying goodbye to the self-aggrandizing romance with corrupt third worldism. Goodbye to the left's self-dramatizing anti-Americanism. Horowitz says a major turning point for him came in 1974 when a friend and colleague was murdered. Horowitz believed it was the work of Black Panthers, but charges were never filed for lack of evidence. The simultaneous conversions of Horowitz and Collier seem to have only strengthened their political partnership of 20 years. In addition to co-editing Ramparts and co-authoring many subsequent articles, Horowitz and Collier are co-authors of books about three American dynasties, the Rockefellers, the Kennedys, and a forthcoming book about the Fords, who made their fortune in the auto industry. They say they find it hard not to be ashamed of some of the things they were involved with in the 60s. I asked for some examples, and David Horowitz spoke first.
Well, I think the most egregious thing we did, as a result of this misguided notion that we had and that seems to be endemic to the left, that the United States is somehow responsible for most of the misery in the world, and that if the United States is weakened, then people are better off. We, in fact, committed treason in the early 70s. As editors of Ramparts magazine, we printed an article by a cryptanalyst for the National Security Agency in which he revealed secrets about the agency. We felt we were doing it as part of our resistance to the war. And as a result of, you know, what we saw at the end of the war, where more people were killed by the communists in the first 3 years of peace than were killed in the 13 years of the anti-communist war, where we see North Vietnam marauding over Indochina, where we see the Russians emboldened to go into Afghanistan, we feel really badly that we are, you know, ashamed, as we said in the article, to have done that.
Peter Collier, do you want to add anything to things, to the list of things that you feel were a mistake that you did in the 60s?
Well, I mean, you know, you have a life, particularly a political life, and, you know, you have to kind of accept it as an organic thing in a certain way. So, I mean, there's by saying that we feel bad, it's not a kind of a wailing and a beating of the chest and all that sort of thing. It's more a sense of kind of the glacial effects, the geological effects of politics on a life. And you see yourself in the past, and you understand that you were weathered by that experience, that there was some kind of erosion, if you will, to carry the metaphor to an extreme. And that, I haven't turned my back on that part of my life. I mean, it's something I did, and something that many of us did on the left at that point. I mean, the thing that is most amazing to me is really that so few of us have come out of it, that there is so little kind of reevaluation, so little reassessment, so little reappraisal, that the left seems to be congenitally unable, in some sense, to seek the bottom line of its experience, not to mention a kind of profit and loss statement.
Is there anything that you feel really holds up or that you're proud of from the 60s, from your work with Ramparts, any articles that you're still really proud of?
Well, I feel good about a movement which in some sense really was a part of the early era but is associated with the 60s, which is the civil rights movement. I believe the civil rights movement was really a conservative revolution, if you like, that in that it extended to black Americans their rights under the Constitution. It completed the writ of the Constitution. And since it's the 200th anniversary, we might note that. And when you think of Martin Luther King, the high tide of that was Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And what he dreamed really was that black Americans should become part of the American dream. And so that I feel very good about. It's where around 1964, really the movement departed from that and began to attack the dream itself and to attack America itself that I, in retrospect, would have done differently had I known, had I had the experience that I now have.
Would you have supported the Vietnam War?
Would I now support the Vietnam War?
If you knew then what you know now.
It's really hard. I kind of feel with David. I went south in the civil rights movement and got shot at and beat the hell out of. I too feel that the Black Power movement, in some sense, washed its hands of Martin Luther King, and a lot of people who have made a kind of a saint out of King today really loathed him during the time, and it's a tremendously hypocritical and cynical maneuver on their part. And I think the war, the war really changed everything in some sense. I mean, it changed me, it changed David, I'm sure it changed you, it changed this society. And, I think a war like that was based on a fiction, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, it was based on a kind of a lie. It was never, there was never an honest sort of approach to what the war was all about. I mean, it would be very difficult, it seems to support that kind of a war, now or any time.
So you don't withdraw your stand on the war from the 60s?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think you can take several positions. I think what Peter says is right. That is that we were deceived, and let's not forget that we were deceived by the Democratic Party. I think you could take the position, and I don't know what I would take confronted again, that Vietnam was not a strategically vital area. But in the anti-war movement, we fought, we resisted the war on several assumptions. One was that it was not about aggression, an aggression from the North to conquer the South. We said that it was about an indigenous revolution in the South. And what we know now, there's really not a lot of controversy about this. What we know now is that it was a conquest of the South, that there were more North Vietnamese regulars in South Vietnam in 1964 or 65 than the white paper, the Johnson administration's white paper, said there were. We know that the NLF doesn't exist anymore, that most of its the adherents of the NLF are either in jail or left the country as boat people or just powerless, that it's run by the North, that the North is an imperialist power now. The Hanoi has conquered Cambodia and is the power in Laos, that even though the Vietnamese are poorer than they were during the war, they have the fourth largest standing army in the world. They have a larger standing army than the United States. So whereas I think that it's a black period in American history, because it was fought on a false basis in ways. It was lies all around. I certainly would not be in the anti-war movement in the way I was then, no.
When did you start reevaluating your politics and moving from the left toward the right?
Well, I think it happened for both of us, although, like I was saying before, I mean, an individual life is comprised, even a political one, is comprised of a lot of things and a lot of crises that don't appear to have anything to do with politics, emotional things ranging from death of parents to marriage and birth of children, these kind of organic things that have some impact on politics but aren't specifically political. But insofar as the political arena itself is concerned, I suppose for me, it began in the mid-70s when I saw what was happening in Southeast Asia. And, there was a movement by parts of the left to criticize that, to criticize our former utopian allies, in Vietnam, and Joan Baez and people like that. In fact, Joan Baez had a very prominent advertisement that she sent around and actually published in the New York Times. And then it was answered by this incredible totalitarian sort of advertisement by kind of the hardcore left, what was left of the left after the new left had kind of burned itself out in this flamboyant theatricality and narcissism. And this other advertisement absolutely denied that any of the things that Joan Baez and some of us were saying were happening in Southeast Asia, that is the conquest of the South by the North, this genocide in Cambodia, denied that this was happening, and denied that the forces there in that area, the indigenous forces, had anything to do with it. If they were to admit that there was genocide in Cambodia, they would always append the addendum, but it has as its ultimate cause, you know, Willie Shaw Cross and that whole benighted theory, the bombing that was done under the Nixon administration. It was a kind of this cherchez la femme sort of emotion on the left, that is, find some way of holding the United States guilty and responsible for any act, however tendentious the connection is. You know, it became oppressive and disgusting. And, you know, when the left then further, when it failed to criticize the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, you know, it was time just to get away from it. The left, I feel, left us in some sense more than we left the left.
Peter, you mentioned that politics is really a combination not only of how you're reacting to the world, but also about things that are happening in your private life, mm-hmm. you know, marriage, divorce, children. What things happened in your private life, if I'm not being too personal, that also contributed to your change in politics?
Well, actually, about the time that I was kind of feeling these tremors, and I must say that, you know, I think David, the same thing happened with David. That is, that you know, the minute I started feeling, the first thing I wanted to do was cover him up, you know, and practice denial. I did not want this ever to happen to me. I mean, leaving the left was like leaving a community. It was a severing of lifelong ties. I mean, even today, David and I are regarded as pariahs, you know, McCarthyites, Reaganites, whatever term of opprobrium you can possibly think of by the people that we had lifelong relationships with, you know. So it was extremely hard. But in my own private life, I suppose, you know, my father was dying of cancer, dying graphically and, you know, for me, tragically. And it was like I had a sense of history as being, at least private history, the history of a human being on this earth, as being a very vulnerable thing. I mean, one of the things on the left, you know, there's a lot of talk about nature versus nurture and a lot of theorizing, but there is a kind of abstraction from the realities of life in some sense. It's almost cultist, I think, the new left was, particularly in that, you know, it has a special language, it has special ways of kind of avoiding the real issues of real mortality. And, you know, this notion that we are born to die, I don't want to mean to become too morbid, is certainly kind of not part of the left's cosmology, you know, in some sense. We are born to do good on this world. Particularly, I think, might be more like it. But anyhow, this notion of this man that I really loved, that I had these tremendous political fights with, this disappearing, I mean, it shocked me into a feeling of, you know, the frailty, the vulnerability of life, and, you know, that you know, I don't want to sound like Voltaire, but you've got to kind of tend your own garden a little bit. You've got to do something about the things you can really do something about, the intimate associations that you have in this world, and stop this kind of savage idealism that the left practices of, you know, pretending to take care of the woes of the world. I think it's a pathology.
How did you feel that your affiliations with the left were undermining personal relationships or actually caring for people who were close to you?
Well, I mean, it seemed to me at the time, and I think in retrospect it is certainly the case, that on the left there's a lot of talk about relationships. But it's everything is overlaid, you know, with a kind of ideological screed, as it were. You know, I can remember going to a wedding once at a new left wedding, in which these people had on their wedding cake, they had the slogan "Smash Monogamy." And to me, that's always been a kind of a metaphor that I've carried with me. This, you know, this intimate moment, this joining of the lives of two people with this reckless disregard, you know, even if it was jokingly, a kind of underlying disregard for, you know, the kind of profound human connection they were supposed to be making, you know. And I think that that moment really is always, it is a kind of metaphor, you know, that there's talk about the family, but smash the family. At that point, the family was a root of imperialism. The family was a root of evil in this world. You know, this is a time, I'm hearing this on the one hand, at a time when I see, you know, the disillusion of this intimate bond I've had with a member of my family, unconsummated bond, I might say, because of, you know, this tremendous generational conflict over the war and over his perception of his history, my perception of my history. So, you know, I mean, it was like the psychologists say, it was cognitive dissonance, you know.
Yeah, I would say that personal relationships, the bottom line is they count for nothing in the left. That when you change, you know, that over a political disagreement, you can end a friendship of 30 or 40 years. It just, when I was young, I grew up in the communist movement. And the time of the Khrushchev report in 1956, Soviet premier gave the secret speech on the crimes of Stalin. And when it was revealed, the whole left was thrown into disarray. And there were divorces, marriages of 20, 30 years were dissolved. Friendships, old friends weren't speaking to each other. And of course, Peter and I have experienced this, you know, in our own generation as well. Once you cross the line, you become an unperson. So I don't think the left really has much regard, or it doesn't really, it's not what it's about. It's about an idea. And the idea is a compassionate idea, but what it allows it to do is to trash America. It's a very destructive compassion.
Did you have any moments of personal revelation like Peter had just mentioned?
Yeah, well, I had a, I was involved in working with, actually, when the 60s were over, and which happened about the time the draft was ended, when middle class college kids no longer faced the draft, that was basically took the steam out of the anti-war movement. At that time, I embarked on a kind of ameliorative project in the East Oakland ghetto with the Black Panther Party, and I was raising money for a school and a community center, which I did. And in order to keep the tax records for this center, I recruited a woman who had done the books for Ramparts. And the Panthers eventually murdered this woman. And I discovered not only was did I feel endangered personally, but I felt the danger coming from the left because I knew the left would defend the Panthers. They would never believe what had happened. Over the years, discovered that that the Panthers had been a gang, and then Peter and I became involved in a story on Faye Stender, who was the attorney for George Jackson, and it was kind of a parallel case where she had made George Jackson, who was a prisoner at the end of the 60s, maximum security prisoner. She had made him a legend, an international legend as a revolutionary, and he then turned around and demanded that she helped him escape jail by providing guns, and she said no. And then 8 years later, a member of the prison gang shot her. And so, you know, from the microcosm of our, like, individual lives, you know, we could see the whole, the macrocosm.
My guests are writers David Horowitz and Peter Collier, who have worked together since the 1960s when they edited Ramparts, which was the leading magazine of the New Left. They've since shifted politically to the right. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guests are Peter Collier and David Horowitz. They've been writing together for about 20 years. They were co-editors of Ramparts magazine, which was a magazine of the New Left in the 1960s. They've switched politically. They are now much more conservative, and they continue to write together. They recently, they've written books about the Kennedy family, the Rockefeller family, and are completing a book on the Fords. Why a 180-degree change? You could have been disillusioned with things that you were seeing on the left and spoken out about it and maintained certain political stands but have spoken out about certain hypocrisies that you felt, certain superficialities or just theatrical effects that you thought were counterproductive. What really accounts for the 180-degree turn in your political view?
I'd just pick up from what Peter said about the left leaving us. I mean, we spent many years still as part of the left trying to raise these issues. And, you know, when we wrote the Faced Ender piece, and we also wrote one on the Weather Underground, basically we were just trying to look. We didn't have draw up conservative conclusions. We didn't, you know, we weren't voting for Ronald Reagan or anything like that. But we were attacked. Because you can't raise the slightest sort of deviant look. You know, there's this a friend of ours, Ron Radosh, wrote a book on the Rosenbergs in which he had the FBI files. It's really clear from them that Julius Rosenberg was, you know, heading aspiring. But just to raise that issue caused him to be called, you know, denounced and so forth. He was driven really from the left. There is no room in the left for people who are honest. I would just put it that way. You cannot be honest and have any kind of integrity and remain a leftist over time.
You both voted for Ronald Reagan for president.
I did in 84. Peter, when was your?
Yeah.
84. So in 80, we voted for Carter.
You both co-authored an article about voting for Reagan in the Washington Post, and I think it really caused quite a stir. Why did you vote for Ronald Reagan?
Well, because at that time, you know, at that point, it seemed to me that that Reagan was really, in some sense, you know, I approve of the Reagan Doctrine, which it seems to me is very much like, in a sense, the Truman Doctrine was.
The doctrine of rolling back
the communist empire. I mean, that Ronald Reagan, in a way that the Democrats could not do, in a way the left cannot do, took cognizance of something that had happened in the world, and that is that Vietnam, our defeat in Vietnam, had changed the world. You know, the left seems to think that the world goes on, America is still the villain, America is still the bully. You know, there was this tremendous vacuum created in which the Soviets moved in and, you know, country after country was feeling Soviet expansionism. You know, the Soviets were using 50,000 Cuban proxies in Africa. I mean, think what would the left do if we supported Pinochet and he sent 50,000 people to go fight on the behalf of the South Africans or something like that?
You've explained that you think you've become pariahs among your former friends and allies on the left. What about the people on the right? Did they welcome you with open arms?
Well, I think they would like to. I mean, to me, that's not the point anymore. I think that, you know, there are things on the right that I don't like. And my own feeling is that once you have been a member of a party, as it were, a member of a group, a member of a cult, I think it's not improper.
The cult meaning the left?
Yeah, it's not improper to call the left a kind of cultic experience. At least it was for us. I think you don't want to repeat that again. And to me, I don't want to spend my life parroting anybody's orthodoxies anymore. You know, I think I can do one thing and do it fairly well, and that is look at the left, look at its manifestations in the current political culture and say, I know you. I know what you are. I know what you're doing. You're not fooling me. And that's quite a different sort of approach to a political life than joining up, you know, a party. I have no intention, and I don't think David does either, of becoming a kind of, right-wing ideologue.
You voted for Ronald Reagan in 84, and as you both mentioned earlier, it became a very kind of symbolic point in your lives because people, you wrote an article about it, people knew you voted for Reagan, people who hadn't heard of you for a while knew that you changed politically. Now that we've had the revelations about the Iran-Contra affair, how do you feel about the Reagan administration and the fact that you voted for him?
Well, I feel, in the first place, I the objective of supporting the Contras, I think, is a noble one. In the second place, part of the reason for the Iran-gate, as it were, is exactly the syndrome that Peter's talking about. And we have now in Congress what I would call a fifth column lobby. That is that there are 10 to 15 congressmen who come out of the culture of which I know very well as an old, you know, having been born into the communist movement, of the pro-communist movement, of the fellow traveling movement of communists. And not only are they a presence in the Congress enough to swing a vote, for example, for and against aid to the Contras. But they have access to sensitive intelligence information. They have been part of the lobby which has handcuffed the and hogtied the CIA and the FBI, and which passed the Boland Amendment, which has limited the powers of the presidency. And in some sense, you know, without this fifth column left in the Congress, you wouldn't have an Ollie North. I personally am disappointed in the Reagan administration in that I feel they should have taken the political battle up front. That is, if support for the Contras is vital to the national security, and if overthrowing the Sandinistas is vital to American security, then they should say so, and they should come out with an out-front political battle.
Are you in the position now of having to do what you said you had to do when you were on the left? And by that, I mean you said you were on the left, and because people didn't break ranks, you supported things that you had doubts about, but you didn't really want to speak out about. Well, are you in the danger of doing that kind of thing now with the Iran-Contra affair, of having to kind of defend it, justify it?
Well, I don't think David was justifying. I think it was a disaster, you know, and I think he would agree with that. But I think he was trying to find a deeper stratum to your question, which is, has it caused any kind of massive doubts about, you know, our support for the principles behind Reaganism, as it is narrowly defined? And I think that, you know, if you mean by that, do we still support the Reagan doctrine, et cetera, you know, I think that that's true. And we do. I mean, but I think we feel it was, you know, it was bad to have that kind of deceit, to, you know, fly in the face of a congressional vote and to go around Congress. Not to speak of the management style. It was, you know, that is more than bad management. It's bad politics. And you know, what should have been done was, you know, there should have been a campaign mounted to convince the people of this country that was a vital security matter. And if you couldn't do that, then you got to give it up.
You are organizing a Second Thoughts conference, bringing together, I guess, people like yourself who've had second thoughts about the left and who have politically changed. What are the goals of the conference?
Well, I think in a very limited sense, the goals are to find the people that have gone through something like what we've gone through and bring them together, create a forum for them to talk about it. And I think the long-range goals are to find in this group people who can, in some sense, join the debate, people who are presently on the sidelines, who are disillusioned, you know, out of it politically, and who yet have something valuable to add to the current debate. You know?
Do you think there's a lot of people like that out there?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people. I think most of the people who have, you know, understood the consequences of what they did and have some second thoughts about it are inactive. That is, if you really give your heart to that kind of idealism and then you see how destructive it is, you just tend to withdraw and, you know, go and do what Peter said, tend your garden.
Okay. I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guests have been David Horowitz and Peter Collier. They've worked together since the 1960s when they co-edited the New Left magazine Ramparts. Over the years, they've shifted politically to the right. They've collaborated on books about three American dynasties, the Kennedys, the Rockefellers, and the Fords, who made their fortune in the auto industry. The book on the Fords is scheduled for publication later this year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll speak with conductor Leonard Slatkin, so I hope you can join us. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, author Susan Cheever talks about her new novel, Doctors and Women. It's partially based on her own experiences during her father John Cheever's death from cancer. Also, book critic John Leonard looks at a new collection of letters from S.J. Perlman. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward takes us back to over 20 years ago when Grace Slick sang with the group The Great Society. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. From time to time this summer, our rock and roll historian Ed Ward will profile some of the performers who emerged around 20 years ago and whose music has been associated with the summer of love. Ed begins today with the music of The Great Society featuring Grace Slick.
Go to San Francisco this summer, flowers in your hair or not, and you're going to discover that they're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Summer of Love. But ask people who lived there back then, and they'll tell you that the real action had peaked a year or so earlier. That was when the bands had shown up, the psychedelic dance halls and nightclubs had appeared, and the community discovered that it was, in fact, a community. Great Society, whom we heard singing Father Bruce, was probably the most technically proficient and daring of these early San Francisco bands. They were formed around a couple of kids with comfortable trust funds, Jerry Slick and his wife Grace Wing Slick, and they weren't like the other bands. For one thing, they weren't old folkies gone electric like the Grateful Dead, and for another, they considered themselves serious musicians. Their bassist, Peter Vandergelder, was studying sarod, an Indian stringed instrument, with Ali Akbar Khan, and Jerry Slick had a reputation as a filmmaker. But it was Jerry's brother Darby who was the band's secret weapon. One afternoon, dumped by his girlfriend and feeling terrible, he picked up his guitar and 20 minutes later had a song written. Later, he still remembered the feeling that Somebody to Love was destined to be a hit. The first big social event to draw the bohemian community together was a dance at Longshoremen's Hall on October 16, 1965, a show billed as The Family Dog Presents a Tribute to Doctor Strange. The Great Society and a folk rock outfit called the Jefferson Airplane were on the bill, and both became instant stars as a result. People especially liked the Great Society's raga-like numbers, like their hypnotic version of the J-Net's Sally Go Round the Roses, and another song that Grace had written.
One pill makes you larger, And one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. And if you go chasing rabbits,
By 1967, the Great Society was falling apart. Grace and Jerry's marriage was on the rocks, and the other members had things they wanted to do. The Jefferson Airplane's vocalist, Signe Tolly Anderson, got pregnant, and they asked Grace to join the band. She accepted and brought those two famous songs with her. Like the one Lyndon Johnson proposed, the Slick's Great Society was a good idea, but it just didn't happen.
Fresh Air's rock and roll historian Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. All the Great Society music you heard was recorded in 1966, live at The Matrix. That was a club on Fillmore Street in San Francisco, owned by Marty Balin, who formed the Jefferson Airplane. Let's go back to The Matrix and listen to The Great Society and a piece called Father. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is writer Susan Cheever. She never planned to follow in the footsteps of her father, writer John Cheever, but she stumbled into a journalism career, which she eventually gave up to write novels. When her father died of cancer, she stopped work on her fourth novel to write a biographical memoir about him titled Home Before Dark. Cancer and hospitals are at the center of her new novel, Doctors and Women. It's about a married woman who falls in love with the oncologist treating her mother. Susan Cheever told me that this novel came out of witnessing her father's final illness.
Doctors and Women, like Home Before Dark, was a book that came out of the experience of having my father be sick and spend a lot of time in hospitals and be treated for cancer and, you know, finally die. And what happened to me was I had always been terrified of cancer and disease and hospitals and doctors, and I had always thought that those things wouldn't happen to me, that they wouldn't be part of my life. And when all of a sudden my father was diagnosed as having terminal cancer, my my terror kind of flipped into obsession, and I started reading everything I could about cancer and finding out everything I could about cancer and hanging out in the hospitals, of course, with him. It made such a difference to me to really understand the disease, the hospitals, the doctors, how the whole thing works, that I wanted to spell that out in a book. I mean, I wanted to communicate that to whoever wanted to read about it. I wish I had had this book, you know, 5 years ago when my father got sick, because it would have saved me a lot of the agony that I went through because of my own ignorance.
Well, Susan, I think I can understand the fear that you had of hospitals and of being in hospitals. And I'd like to read a passage from your novel, Doctors and Women, in which you describe being in a hospital. And you write, "In the hospital, the world closes down into a narrow, vivid focus. Only the hospital seems real. Life is stripped down to its essentials, like travel in a mountainous, dangerous country. The real world is a small, dark room where people come in and out to prod and poke and ask the same questions over and over: beige walls, beds on wheels, fluorescent lights, meals on trays, chipped paint, the smell of antiseptic, and in the distance, the sound of someone screaming." For me, it was that last part, the sound of someone screaming, that really got to me, because that's always happening whenever I'm in a hospital, either as a patient or as a visitor, and I find it terrifying.
You know, I've spent a lot of time in hospitals, both with my father, and also I have a daughter she's fine, but has had some bouts with illness. And I lived, I guess, last year for about a week in the pediatrics ward at Mount Sinai because my daughter had pneumonia. And it's interesting how you deal with that. You either back off and, you know, go into an even smaller world so that you don't hear the screaming, or you start to get involved in it. And what I did was, of course, I got very involved in the pediatrics ward, and I ended up taking care of some babies, because they're just, you know, in a lot of these hospitals, and Mount Sinai is certainly not an inner city hospital, there just really isn't enough help.
There's an interesting detail when the main character goes into the office of the doctor that's treating her mother. She finds that there's all kinds of interesting objects,
right,
in the office, sculptures and rare items, this and that. And she asks where they're from, and he says that they're all gifts from patients. And I wonder how you found out about that, if that's typical, that surgeons end up getting a lot of gifts from their patients.
Oh, it's completely typical, and it's not just surgeons. But I think this, the patient becomes a child and also a suppliant in the hospital. In other words, you're always asking, you're always pleading, you're always hoping. I don't want to say reduces, but it really brings out a very odd aspect of most people's character. And you particularly see this in New York, where a great many people are outside the hospital, tremendously powerful and responsible. Inside the hospital, they become very different. And one of the few ways that you can exercise your outside power inside is to give expensive presents.
There are two daughters in your novel who play a caretaking role in the lives of their mothers, who both have cancer. Did that happen to you? Were you helping to take care of your father during his last years?
Oh, sure. We all helped. My brothers, my mother, and I. And the two or three people who'd been close to him all really pitched in. There's a tremendous amount of work to do when somebody's that sick. I certainly was very much there. I was pregnant when my father was dying. And in a way, it was very difficult. But in another way, it was very nice for me to be able to be taking care of him at such an important time in my own life.
You know, that's one of those ironies that one never knows how to handle.
Right. It was hard, but I felt, you know, walking around the cancer ward, I felt really good about being 8 months pregnant. I felt that I was representing something to the people who I was talking to, particularly to my father, but really to the other people that I got to know on those floors, that I was representing something nice.
You had to spend a lot of time in the hospital because of your father's terminal illness, mm-hmm. and also because your baby was sick a couple of times. But then your novel kept you in the hospital. When you didn't have to be in the hospital,
right.
you were in your office thinking about the hospital and describing that. Did that get to be an emotional burden?
Well, it was part of this process, you know, that I described before of coming to understand the hospital. My way of dealing with things that terrify me is to find out about them and understand them, and then they're not so terrifying. It's not everyone's way, but it's my way. And you know, a lot of people ask me if it wasn't depressing hanging out in the hospital, and it wasn't at all, because people under those kinds of pressures really behave. I mean, the joke is that, you know, when you're going to die, you really mind your manners. But it's deeper than that. I saw people at their absolute best. And, you know, I would go over to the hospital on the bus. And on the bus, people are kicking each other in the shins and yelling at each other. And the bus driver's screaming at some woman with kids because she takes too long to get on the bus. You get into the hospital, people are very aware of how much is at stake. And their best selves emerge. They're people who are really thinking about their families, their interactions with other people, what they're going to do with the rest of their lives, if there is a rest of their lives. They're people really in the process of evaluating, of stepping back and doing the kinds of evaluations of their lives that we all should be doing.
I know that while your father was alive, you didn't like to let him see your writing until it was basically in galleys. Was that so he wouldn't be able to change it or criticize you for it?
Well, I think it was two reasons. It was because I was afraid that he would say something that would stop me. In other words, yes, to answer your question, yes. But I think it was also to spare him the weight of having, of being in the tremendously uncomfortable position of having to say that he liked it or didn't like it under the circumstances. In other words, my father was a tremendously honest, direct, and painfully direct man, and we didn't share the same tastes in writers. We liked many different things and had very different interests, and I could see that for me it could be excruciating, and for him it could be excruciating.
Would it have crippled you if he told you that this isn't any good?
Well, no. No. Well, one factor here is that I didn't start writing fiction until I was 35. So I was, by that time, I don't think anything could have crippled me. You know. But I certainly wouldn't have been happy. Or maybe I would have liked it better. Hard to tell. You know, hard to tell. But it certainly wouldn't have helped my friendship with him.
You were the child of a novelist, and now you're the parent novelist of of a child. Are there any things you do or don't want to do as a parent novelist?
There's some very very obvious things. My father used me in fiction quite a bit, and in one particular story, the little girl is killed in a ski tow accident, and when I came on that story when I was, say, 12 years old, I was very upset. And I, you know, being my father's daughter was in many ways wonderful. I mean, I've never been anyone else's daughter. I mean, I think Home Before Dark is a testimony to my love for him and my gratitude for what he gave me. But I wasn't thrilled as a child to be exposed in that way. And I think I would not do that to my child. I think I'd be a little more careful. I'm older. I'm older than my father was. And I think that makes a big difference, too.
Susan Cheever, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Susan Cheever's new novel is called Doctors and Women. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Well, Oliver North took the stand today.
Yes, he did, Terry. And yes, according to Oliver North's testimony today, he did arrange for arms sales to Iran. Yes, he diverted money to the Contras. Yes, it was good for the country, according to Oliver North, but he always assumed the president knew, and no, he had no proof of that. So we'll have a report on Oliver North's testimony and other reports from the Iran-Contra hearings. Also tonight on All Things Considered.
That's La Bamba, but it's not the original Ritchie Valens hit recording.
No, that one is from Los Lobos. That's among a number of recordings we'll hear tonight in our search for La Bamba.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Some of the letters the American humorist S.J. Perlman wrote to his friends and colleagues have been gathered in a new book called Don't Tread on Me. The letters were written between the 1920s and 1979, the year Perlman died. Our book critic John Leonard has this review.
S.J. Perlman was always leaving town, for Hollywood or Asia or Africa. Then he came home to be funny, when they would let him, in the pages of The New Yorker and Holiday and Red Book. To be funny, as in Perlman, you had to wear the vernacular like a hair shirt, to have read all the newspapers and gone to all the movies and heard all the songs, to have perfect pitch for the absurd tone. You had to be equally at home in high culture and in low, with Mandarin modernism and the slang of gangsters. It's no surprise to find here letters to both T.S. Eliot and Raymond Chandler, to Edmund Wilson and Groucho Marx. What is surprising is to find so much anger and melancholy. He was, of course, a perfectionist. I alternate, he wrote, between periods of violence and despair when I consider what faces anybody who wants to really write as well as he can. And he was usually broke. And he was expected always to be hilarious, on cue with the verbal pratfall and the radical juxtaposition and the surreal swoon. A clown gets tired. He wants to hole up with a friend, a hot bird, and a cold bottle. But his anger and melancholy in these letters are political as well as personal. From fascism to blacklisting, his times were contemptible. He hated Germans, despised the Dutch, loathed India, and didn't much like himself for having to work in Hollywood with, quote, a flock of beetle-brained windsuckers with necks hinged so they can yes Daryl Zanuck. He had as little use for Nixon as he did for Acapulco, and no use at all for Andy Warhol and Barbara Walters. He disdained a number of his colleagues at The New Yorker, including John Updike and Donald Barthelme. Barthelme is the amazement here. I would have thought Barthelme and Max Apple were his precocious children. Malcolm Muggeridge, the editor of Punch, was, quote, a chatterbox, all smile and prussic acid, bristling with insincerity. And Mike Todd, for whom Perlman wrote the screenplay for Around the World in 80 Days, was, quote, a sinister dwarf, an ulcer no larger than a man's hand. This isn't to say that Don't Tread on Me is all gloom. There's more humor in any one of his vituperations than in a whole decade of sitcoms. And he has his enthusiasms, among them V.S. Naipaul, Bernard Malamud, Janet Flanner, George V. Higgins, Bella Abzug, and Afghanistan. It's just that his editor, Prudence Crowther, a young friend of his last years, was unable to secure any of the letters to people like Robert Benchley and Dorothy Parker and Lillian Hellman. And there's something sad about his warning his daughter in boarding school to stay away from Dostoevsky, to read Booth Tarkington instead, as if he had lived too long himself with Dostoevsky. When he left town, he liked to bring back exotic birds. He was especially partial to mynas. He explained to a friend, "To teach them, you have to cover their cage with a dark cloth and endlessly chant some word until they repeat it. This haunts me. And so do these letters from the clown unbuttoned and at bay."
Our book critic John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Don't Tread on Me, the selected letters of S.J. Perlman. Here's what's coming up on our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with Kennedy Fraser, the fashion writer for The New Yorker magazine. Her new book is titled Scenes from the Fashionable World. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review two new recordings of Beethoven's symphony cycles performed on original instruments. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will help us decipher corporate language. So I hope you can join us. And we want to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Fred Landerl, with producers Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Research assistance from Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.